This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Where this evening, for the first 45 minutes or so, I'm going to be talking about the 10th GOP debate last night, which was really a bit of a mud fight, really raucous, people talking over one another. I want to begin. I found a wonderful article by Chris Caliza that gives a framework for my commentary, but I want to begin with a three-minute summary overview who provides of the debate. Just to give you a sense of what it was like. Chance.
Welcomed legal immigrants, but I think it is a mistake to forgive those who break the law to allow them to become U.S. citizens.
I don't think we're going to tear families apart. I don't think we're going to ride around in people's neighborhoods and grab people out of their homes. I don't think it's practical, and I don't think it reflects America.
The wall just got 10 feet taller.
You're the only person on the stage that's ever been fined for hiring people to work on your projects illegally. You hired some workers from Poland.
No, I'm the only one on the stage that's hired people. You haven't hired anybody.
He hired workers from Poland, and he had to pay $1 million or so in a judgment.
That's wrong.
That's totally wrong. Well, people can look it up. I'm sure people are Googling it right now.
Look
it up.
Trump.
Polish workers.
I won with every single category. I won with men. I won with high income, low income. I won with Hispanics.
You look at the values in the Hispanic community. The values in our community are faith, family, patriotism.
I do think it's amazing that on the stage tonight, there are two descendants of immigrants of Cuban origin and an African American. We are the party of diversity, not the Democratic Party.
You can say whatever you want, but they have millions of women going through Planned Parenthood that are helped greatly.
This is an important thing. What is your plan? I understand the lines around the state, whatever that means. This is not a game where you draw maps
and
around.
You don't know what it means.
What is your plan?
That's the problem.
What is your plan on health care? You don't
have a
plan.
If you're in the business of selling things, if you're not going to sell to somebody you don't agree with, okay, today I'm not going to sell to somebody who's gay, and tomorrow maybe I won't sell to somebody who's divorced. I mean, if you're in the business of commerce, conduct commerce.
As president, I would go through and I would look at what a person's life has been. What have they done in the past? What kind of judgments have they made? What kind of associations do they have? That will tell you a lot more than an interview will tell you. The fruit salad of their life is what I will look at.
I am very pro-Israel, very pro, more than anybody on the stage. But it doesn't do any good to start demeaning the neighbors, because I would love to do something with regard to negotiating peace, finally, for Israel and for their neighbors.
This is another area on which Donald agrees with Hillary Clinton and on which I disagree with them both strongly.
The bottom line is a deal between Israel and the Palestinians, given the current makeup of the Palestinians, is not possible.
Okay.
The Palestinians are not a real estate deal, Donald.
Okay. I've been a supporter of Israel, strong supporter of Israel, longer than anybody on this stage. I didn't give as much money as Donald gave.
If these politicians went to the beach and didn't do a thing, and we had Saddam Hussein, and if we had Gaddafi in charge, instead of having terrorism all over the place, would be at least they killed terrorists, all right?
The time for games is over. I know you've had a lot of choices to make, but now it's time to narrow it down, and I'm asking you to get behind me.
Now, Chris Caliza writes for the Washington Post, which may be politically the most important paper in the country because it's published in Washington, D.C. and read by virtually every politician, along with the New York Times, but where I think the Post actually is more reliable as a guide to what's going on in the District of Columbia. So I want to go through Chris Caliza's summary of the winners and the losers and comment upon them. His article is entitled "The Winners and Losers from the 10th Republican Presidential Debate." The 10th Republican presidential debate is in the books. I watched, tweeted, and took some notes. My best and worst from the night that was is below. Let me just say by way of preface that when they got into a discussion of religious liberty, all three of the principals, Cruz, Trump, and Rubio, seemed to fail to distinguish between one's personal preferences and one's role responsibility. If you are a deputy sheriff, for example, and required to enforce the law, you're not at liberty to pick and choose which laws you enforce. And if you're a pharmacist, even if you are averse to birth control and abortion, you're not at liberty to not fulfill your obligation as a pharmacist. In fact, if that's your desire, not to fulfill prescriptions for the morning after pill or for birth control pills or what have you, you simply have no business being in that profession. And to me, it was rather troubling that none of these three principals seem to appreciate the difference between the responsibilities you assume when you're in a certain designated role, such as being a deputy sheriff or a pharmacist, and your personal preferences. Religious liberty does not extend to your right to pick and choose which laws to enforce or to pick and choose which prescriptions to fill. So I find it really staggering in its implications that none of the three were capable of drawing that distinction. Okay, Chris Colizzo, winners. Marco Rubio, this was not only Rubio's best debate performance, it was the best debate performance by any candidate in any debate so far in the 2016 election. Rubio, grasping the fact that if nothing changes in this race, he and everyone else will lose to Donald Trump, hit Trump at every turn. He savaged Trump on using illegal immigrants to help build Trump Tower. He went after Trump for inheriting money. He hit Trump for his position on Israel and Palestine, and most importantly, he rattled Trump during a back and forth over Obamacare. It reminded me of this moment from another great battle between two titans. And here, intersperse a clip from Rocky IV. What Rubio's stellar performance means is that the race between now and Tuesday and March 15th and beyond will be cast as a two-man showdown between Trump and Rubio. That's the only chance Rubio has of winning. What I don't know is whether the punches Rubio landed will do any lasting damage to Trump. Nothing else has yet. Well, I don't think that Rubio, although he was very spirited, spunky, aggressive, landed any blows that Trump cannot sustain and even shake off. The talk about using illegal immigrants to help build Trump Tower, excuse me, was over 30 years ago, and the hiring practices and so forth were very different. That seemed to me not to be significant. He went after Trump for inheriting money, but that's just a circumstance of Trump's life. His father apparently bequeathed to some four members of the family $200 million that was divided among them. I can't see anything objectionable about that. He hit Trump for his position on Israel and Palestine, where Trump repeated that he is going to regard it as the greatest challenge he's ever confronted to make a deal between Israel and Palestine. But, and this was one of the disappointing aspects of the evening, all of the candidates seemed to want to exceed one another in avowing their dedication and loyalty to Israel, even though Israel has been behind many traumatic events for this country, including, of course, 9/11, which was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, and the Mossad, where the neocons came from the Project for a New American Century, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. who believe there was a unique historical opportunity with the demise of the Soviet Union to create an American empire that might endure for the next 100 years. If only Americans would awaken and seize the opportunity to move aggressively into the geopolitically sensitive Middle East and exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from that region, they bemoaned the opportunity might be lost were there not some traumatic catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor, and went about arranging it, which, of course, were the events of 9/11, which were calculated to instill fear into the American people that we were under attack by a foreign power, and to transform American foreign policy from one at which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became an aggressor nation, initially launching an attack on Afghanistan, and not long thereafter invaded Iraq, where it seems to me that Trump has distinguished himself by observing that W, contrary to Jeb's assertions, did not keep us safe, did not show due diligence, even on the official account. The Bush-Cheney administration did not take measures appropriate to defend the country from attack, and therefore Jeb's pronouncement that his brother kept us safe was simply a ridiculous claim for him to have made, where Trump stripped away the veneer and exposed the hypocrisy, the utter lack of substance behind that claim. He condemned our invasion of Iraq as totally unnecessary, that he asserted that both Libya with Gaddafi and Iraq under Hussein Saddam were much better off than they are today. And frankly, I don't believe there's any basis for contesting that. And he's also bemoaned the squandering of $4 to $5 trillion for no good, turning the Middle East into chaos. Not acknowledging, however, that that's precisely the outcome that the Israelis intended, to use American military force to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the Middle East. As far as Rubio going back and forth over Obamacare, it was that Trump has yet to spell out with any specificity what he's going to do to replace Obamacare. Frankly, the only candidate on either side who has the right solution to that problem is Bernie Sanders, who's talked about expanding Medicare, where the bureaucracy is already there in place. Medicare was always intended to be extended, and where I believe that once Trump is in office, you're going to find that he's open-minded to solutions from all sides, and I frankly believe he will adopt that approach to replace Obamacare, which is, in fact, the right solution. So, in my judgment, although Rubio looked like a feisty fighter, I don't think he actually did any enduring damage to Trump, even though he awakened this morning expecting that his advantages over Trump the night before would be the talk of the airwaves, only to have them eclipsed by an endorsement of Trump by Chris Christie, who's an establishment politician, which has frankly shaken up the establishment considerably because of a few establishment politicians of the stature of Chris Christie endorsed Trump. The establishment opposition will essentially have crumbled. Here's another curious, which Chris Cazilla says is a winner, Mitt Romney. The 2012 Republican presidential nominee has been a low-profile figure in this race. No longer. First came this tweet, Mitt Romney. He thinks that Donald doth protest too much. Show voters your back taxes. Sure, Romney came under full frontal assault from Trump during the debate, but questions over when Trump and the other candidates will release their taxes took up a considerable amount of debate time. That demonstrates Romney is still able to drive conversation within the GOP. But frankly, if you know the history, this is simply absurd. Romney put off again and again and again releasing his taxes as the Donald observed, he would only release them on like September 21st, many, many months in the future. So Romney was grandstanding, trying to get a role here. Chris Cazilla fell for it. I think it was a pathetic effort by Romney. I most certainly don't regard him as a winner. Chris also observed crosstalk. There were times, lots of times, when two or three or even four candidates were trying to speak at the same time. This was crosstalk's finest hour in its unending march to make America great again. And it gives a nice example where Chris Ahrens tweeted, "Mad props to the transcription service for getting it right when they were all talking over one another." Frankly, why Chris Kaliza should regard this as a winner, crosstalk, is beyond me, because it made all the candidates look juvenile. He also cites fruit salad as delicious and nutritious in relation to Ben Carson, who barely got a few words in edgewise, and who at one point appealed, "Can't somebody attack me too, so I'll get a little time here?" Losers. Ted Cruz. Cruz watched, and I do mean watch, as Rubio turned the race into a two-man contest between him and Trump. Cruz was strangely absent from the back and forths of the night. To the extent Cruz was able to get into a debate with Trump, he spent his time hitting the real estate mogul for making past donations to Democrats. Cast me as skeptical that that line of attack will work. Cruz also tried to make the electability case against Trump, but found himself hoist on his petard by the Donald, who noted that the senator's polls aren't in a great place. Cruz looked like the third wheel in this debate, a bad place to be with March 1st just 5 days away. Now, as an aside, it looks possible, even probable, that Cruz is going to win Texas for the following reason. Texans have been voting absentee since January. And since Cruz is the senator from Texas, undoubtedly during all the months, you know, before next Tuesday, he will have accumulated quite a substantial number of votes in Texas. I therefore believe it's unlikely that Trump can knock off Cruz in Texas. On the other hand, Florida is a completely different matter, where Ted Cruz is running a double-digit lead over Marco Rubio, and where my belief is, if Rubio cannot carry Florida, his home state, then he's essentially out of it. Donald Trump. This wasn't Trump's worst debate. In fact, it might not even be in the bottom half of his performances. He generally counterpunched admirably, particularly against Cruz. But Rubio got the better of Trump on several occasions. The senator from Florida found ways to embarrass and mock Trump, which is something no one in any previous debate has been able to do. Rubio also effectively exposed the thinness of Trump's policy solutions, especially on health care. Well, it seems to me that the Donald missed an opportunity when Rubio was attacking him for his proposal to mediate a solution between Israel and Palestine by suggesting, "What qualifications do you have? You're a real estate guy." But so much of the issue between Israel and Palestine is a real estate issue. Who deserves what land? And in that case, I think that Trump's background in a real estate context is going to come to be profoundly beneficial. There were remarks said that the Palestinians had walked away from every proposal, but it's really the Israelis who have been intransigent. It's really the Israelis who have held up any resolution. They don't really want one. The final solution for Israelis, including Bibi Netanyahu, would be to load all the Palestinians aboard a ship, float it out to sea, and sink it. That's their idea of the solution to the Palestinian problem. Chris continues, "I am under no illusion, and no Republican operative or candidate should be either, that Rubio's punches on Trump are guaranteed to slow the real estate billionaire's momentum in advance of Tuesday's primaries. But Trump didn't escape this debate unscathed, and if he can be cut, he was. However, I hasten to add that after Tuesday, when Rubio loses Florida, the situation will be transformed. In my opinion, Rubio will have lost whatever scant momentum he may have obtained from this debate. Chris continues, Ben Carson, John Kasich. You could be forgiven for having forgotten that either the retired neurosurgeon or the Ohio governor were part of this debate. Carson and Kasich got almost no questions, and the ones they did get, they seemed unprepared to handle. Carson somehow made a fruit salad reference, see above, when asked about Supreme Court nominees. Kasich used every question to talk about how we all need to get along. Both men felt entirely ancillary to the proceedings, as though they were engaged in a different event than the one Troop Rubio and Cruz were participating, which, of course, they sort of were. By the way, I received a post from a desperate supporter of the establishment who suggested that the only way to resolve this was to combine a ticket with Rubio and Kasich and put Cruz on the Supreme Court. Now, that's at least imaginative. I don't think it's going to fly, but there it is. The shrieker. Who was this person and why did she shriek before the candidates even finished what they were saying? Was she pro-Rubio, pro-Trump? I have no idea. One thing I do know, she was anti my ears. My bladder. CNN went from 8:40 until 10 p.m. without a single commercial break. I like to stay hydrated. I did drink water. I drink green tea. A man needs a commercial break more than every 80 minutes. Come on, man. What are we even doing out here? Well, that's not quite right. It is true that the debate ran approximately 2.5 hours, but it's false that there was no break. There actually was a break, and I'm a bit surprised that Chris Colizzo should have missed it. Now, I believe that there's no stopping Trump at this point in time and that he has a virtually insurmountable lead. And I gather we have a question in the chat room, which I'm asking for Chance to share with me before I continue to the next story. Chance?
Hey, Jim. I just noticed from the chat room, because we've been doing this new YouTube streaming and there's a lot more people actively watching. A lady asks, what does Jim think of Donald Trump / Rand Paul ticket, and how can we prevent the ways that the election was rigged by Diebold, as documented in the film Hacking Democracy for the 2016 election?
Well, those are really excellent questions, and frankly, the idea of a Trump-Rand Paul ticket has crossed my mind before, so I do not believe that's out of the question. The beauty is that Rand is such an insider with regard to the Senate that he would provide Trump with an enormous boost in how to deal with the Congress. And because Rand Paul has such a thoughtful position about foreign policy, essentially non-interventionist, it seems to me that's very consistent with Trump's condemnation of the wars in the Middle East, and that we would have been far better off to have used that $4 to $5 trillion at home to build our roads, our bridges, our schools, provide more education, strengthen the military, where many fail to appreciate how these constant rotations in the Middle East have actually been weakening our military, and where a lot of sleight of hands have been performed to conceal from the American people the vast number of troops. For example, when we had some 500,000 acknowledged American soldiers in Iraq, there appears to have been another 500,000 mercenaries from armies, private armies like Blackwater, there too. And that was a particularly bad situation. The Blackwater people were being paid like 10 times or more what the American troops were. They felt themselves unbound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They performed all kinds of slaughter of Iraqis. If a Blackwater convoy was going by and an Iraqi just happened to drive by and they didn't like his look, they machine gunned him to death. It's appalling. That's what took place. As far as ensuring no theft of elections, I have talked about this again and again and again until I'm blue in the face. I can't even get figures here in Wisconsin to understand that Scott Walker and the Republican legislature are going wild in wanting to sell off state property, weaken environmental safeguards, weaken labor laws, and a host of others in their ongoing efforts to transform Wisconsin into the Mississippi of the Midwest because they control the voting machines. And I've demonstrated it in an article I published about voter fraud versus election theft, Governor Scott Walker's reelection, which you can find online, both at Veterans Today, but also at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. We're in collaboration with Richard Charnin, who's a brilliant statistician. We expose not only that the reelection race with Mary Burke was fraudulent, which should have been obvious on its face. There was an historic turnout, which invariably favors Democrats. They were enthusiastic because Michelle Obama had been here twice, Barack once, and even the big dog Bill Clinton. And yet, in this bastion of Democratic support in Milwaukee County, the larger the number of votes cast, the greater the percentage that went to Scott Walker. I believe that, in essence, they flipped the vote, that the total of 53 for Walker, 47 for Burke was precisely the opposite of what was actually cast. But as Stalin observes, it doesn't matter who casts the vote. What matters is who counts them. And until the Democratic Party recognizes that the GOP is stealing one election after another, I don't think there's much hope of Democrats to prevail. The situation is very, very bad. It's my number one recommendation for regaining control of our own democracy, abandoning electronic voting machines. Number two, getting rid of gerrymandered congressional districts, following the Iowa model, which uses a panel of retired judges to perform redistricting in an equitable fashion. Number three, getting private money out of federal elections, all of which, it seems to me, should be publicly financed. And fourth, restoring the draft, which may sound counterintuitive, but ever since Nixon abolished the draft, the American public has not felt a sense of involvement in decisions of war and peace because they knew their own sons and daughters were at risk. Let somebody else do it. If you restore the draft, suddenly you get the public engaged again because they know that these decisions may affect their own children. And therefore, I highly recommend it. So those were excellent questions. And those were my replies. Now, something rather remarkable has occurred because we have the man I regard as the nation's leading public intellectual, Paul Craig Roberts, published an article entitled "Do Americans Live in a False Reality Created by Orchestrated Events?" And I'll just read you a few paragraphs. I've republished it on my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, but you can also just put in the name Paul Craig Roberts and it'll turn up. And interestingly, it's been republished by Strategic Culture, which is one of the best websites in the world for geopolitical issues. It was published as the editor's choice. And I'm very happy with that because Paul Craig Roberts was going into the issue of a host of cases where it looks as though Washington has been resorting to lies again and again. Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, Iranian nukes, Assad's use of chemical weapons, Russian invasion of Ukraine, and a whole lot others, where the media has been particularly appalling by its complete acceptance of whatever government authorities have said about alleged terrorist events such as 9/11, the Marathon bombing, or the alleged mass shootings at Sandy Hook and San Bernardino. And I was just fascinated to learn that in the course of his discussion, when he gets to Sandy Hook, he cites a video from TV news coverage, which shows a man by the name of David Wheeler, who was presumably a grieving father who lost a child at Sandy Hook. Also, walking up and down Dickinson Drive, the only road into Sandy Hook, in camouflage, carrying a weapon upside down by the magazine. Now, as a former Marine Corps officer, I can tell you, this is somebody who knows nothing about weapons. Carrying a weapon upside down by the magazine is ridiculous. The magazine can be inserted and removed. If he has it just the wrong way, it's going to come right out and the weapon's going to fall on the ground. And this was a farce. And this is a simply excellent explosive video that shows fakery was going on, where David Wheeler and his wife Francine, who are B or even C grade actors, were actually flown by Barack Obama to Washington, D.C., where they, Francine in particular, was given the opportunity to give an emotional appeal for gun control from the White House. Now, it's a very rare event, but it's part and parcel of Obama's ongoing campaign against our rights under the Second Amendment. Well, get this. About a third of the way into the article, he says, there is a book by Professor Jim Fetzer and Mike Palachek that says Sandy Hook was a FEMA drill to promote gun control and that no one died at Sandy Hook. The book was available on Amazon.com, but was suddenly banned. Why ban a book? Here's a free download of the book, and he gives the link to Rants, where a very large number of copies of the PDF, which I released to the public for free as soon as the book was banned by Amazon.com, have been downloaded. I have a friend who has been tracking the number of those searching for the book, and he has found the numbers in the millions, and then Google adjusts the number dramatically downward, and then it climbs up into the millions again. So it's his surmise that the book may have been downloaded as much as a million times, possibly even more, which is very gratifying to me, because I expect had Amazon not banned the book, that it might have sold 4,000 to 8,000 copies. And now, if what he's reporting to me is correct, it may have instead have millions of readers. And where those who are interested in obtaining a bound copy can still do so at moonrockbooks.com, because we have in the meanwhile obtained a new printer and a new distributor. So the benefit of the PDF is that the photographs are all in color. It would have been prohibitively expensive for us to have published them in color in the bound volume. So you can have the best of both worlds. If you want to have a bound book that you can take with you, you can obtain one at Moonrock Books, or if you want to have the PDF with the photographs in color, you can download it for free. Paul Craig Roberts continues, I have not read the book and have no opinion. I do know, however, that the police state that America is becoming certainly has a powerful interest in disarming the public. I also heard today a news report that people said to be parents of the dead children are bringing a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer, which is consistent with Fetzer's claim. Well, this is a bizarre lawsuit claiming that by manufacturing an effective weapon, Remington was thereby violating the law. But they're going to have a tough row to hoe here, because Adam Lanza did not himself purchase the weapon. According to the official narrative, which is, of course, poppycock, he stole it from his mother. So, you know, this is just one more way of trying to find a new angle to push for the psyop that these parents actually lost children at Sandy Hook, when we, 13 contributors, including 6 PhD, current or retired college professors, have demonstrated that the school was closed by 2008, that there were no children there, and therefore none for Adam Lanza to have shot, and that it was done to promote gun control. Even one of the photographs I regularly shows exhibits several anomalies just looking down on the parking lot of the school, because the cars are parked improperly in relation to driving instructors. You'd come in on Dickinson Drive, turn to the right, peel around, and then park facing away from the school. But they found it so much simpler just to bring in the cars in a line to serve as props that they just filled them in two by two, all facing the school. Obviously something wrong. In the second place, the school is not Americans with Disability Act compatible. None of the familiar white and blue painted parking areas and signage, which is further substantiation that the school had been closed by 2008. I believe that upgrading the school and making it compliant with the ADA may have been the precipitating cause of the decision to abandon the school. And then if you look closely, you see there's no heat or steam rising from the building. The ground temperature was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. There should have been heat coming from the building, but the boilers were so decrepit they couldn't heat them up. So you have a cold building, which is just fine because there were no students there anyway. The school was closed, along with a host of other points. No surge of EMTs into the building, no string of ambulances to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they can be declared to be dead or alive. No medevac helicopter called. No evacuation of what should have been 469 other students. Steven Sedensky, the state's attorney, who conducted, from Danbury, who conducted the final report, explained that there should have been 489 students there that day. Subtract 20, you have 469. The police reported locations and times where they were being evacuated, but we have dash cam footage, and it shows no evacuation. And while people often think that you can't prove a negative, that's simply wrong. You can prove there's no elephant in your living room, for example, by going to your living room and looking for signs of the presence of elephant. If there are none, when there ought to be, you're entitled to conclude there's no elephant in your living room. Similarly, if you're given locations and times for an evacuation, and you go there and look, and no evacuation is taking place, you're entitled to infer that's because there was no evacuation. In fact, we include an interview Sophia Smallstorm had with Paul Preston, who was in a Los Angeles area superintendent of schools, who was so troubled by what he saw in the reporting from Newtown that he reached to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no one had died, and that was done to promote gun control. For goodness sake, we even have the manual for the two-day drill. Rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th. There was so much confusion among the participants that many put up donation websites already on the 13th, the day before the event had occurred, and even Adam Lanza's date of death was initially recorded in the Social Security Death Index as having occurred on the 13th, making his feat in shooting 20 children and 6 adults the following day all the more remarkable. Well, he continues here, Paul Craig Roberts. Here is a buzzsaw interview with Jim Fetzer, and he gives the link. If the information Fetzer provides is correct, clearly the U.S. government has an authoritarian agenda and is using orchestrated events to create a false reality for Americans in order to achieve the agenda. Now, Buzzsaw is hosted by Sean Stone, who is the son of Oliver Stone, the director of the magnificent film Oliver, JFK, and many others. And it was a lively exchange, but it was strictly, you know, a conversation between him and me. There was no occasion for me to provide visual support for the points I was making. Paul Craig Roberts continues. It seems to me that Fetzer's facts can be easily checked. If his facts checked out, then a real investigation is required. If his facts do not check out, the official story grains credibility, as Fetzer is one of the most energetic skeptics. Fetzer cannot be dismissed as a kook. He graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University, has a PhD from Indiana University, and was distinguished McKnight University professor at the University of Minnesota until his retirement in 2006. He has had a National Science Foundation fellowship. He has published more than 100 articles and 20 books on philosophy of science and philosophy of cognitive science. He's an expert in artificial intelligence and computer science and founded the international journal Minds and Machines. Well, there's more. It's just a wonderful article because Paul Craig Roberts is, in my judgment, our nation's leading public intellectual. And for him to take a stand is going to, in my opinion, bring down the barriers that have inhibited many from taking a look at what they were worried was somehow irresponsible reporting, as though those of us involved in this would not have done our homework before we published the book. In fact, there are 20 books that Amazon was carrying on Sandy Hook, 19 of which were in agreement with the government's account, only of one of which disagreed, which sets the example that if you disagree with the government about an issue, you may have your book banned. Well, Paul Craig Roberts, as I say, this article is getting around. Many people are watching the buzzsaw. And as it happened in Portland this weekend, I gave a presentation, which on Sunday, which to my surprise already by Monday night had been posted up on YouTube. So I sent it to Paul Craig Roberts, and he added it to his blog under the heading, Professor Jim Fetzer Tells Us Things That the Prestitutes Do Not. In this video, Professor Jim Fetzer examines 9/11, Boston Marathon bombing, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, and the Paris attack. It is a very challenging presentation that reflects exhaustive investigation, which I appreciated greatly, and where after this break, we will return for you to have the opportunity to view that program and to judge it for yourself. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. We'll be right back with False Flags Are Real, Professor Jim Fetzer in Portland.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, Framing the Patsy, and The Silent Historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
I will be providing a sampler of what are commonly referred to as conspiracy theories under the heading of false flags from 9/11 to Sandy Hook and beyond. I'll be giving you a sketch of some key elements that are intended to constitute a proof that what you have been told about each of the events I address is untrue. Provably untrue, and in some cases not even scientifically possible because it involves violations of the laws of physics, of aerodynamics, of engineering, what have you. I'll be talking about 9/11, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, San Bernardino, and for international flavor, Paris. I have 90 slides. It will take me approximately 90 minutes to cover them, and at that point I'll be glad to take your questions about anything I've addressed or that I have not. So let's begin with 9/11 and a sampler of impossibilities. Jamie McIntyre reported on national television that day that from his own close-up inspection there was no sign of any large plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. What he said was absolutely true, but he would subsequently be pressured to retract it and did it in the following way by saying, only a fool would deny that a plane had hit the Pentagon, indicated that he had been foolish to state the truth about the situation when that would turn out not to be his producers, directors, and corporate owners' preference. Here's my favorite photograph where you see the two civilian lime green fire trucks extinguishing the very modest fires at the Pentagon. But notice the lawn, perfectly clear, green, unblemished. Here's the alleged hit point. It's about 10 feet high, 16 or 17 feet wide. There's a chain link fence, two cars, a couple large spools of cable, unbroken windows. No massive pile of debris from a 100-ton aluminum airliner, no wings, no tails, no bodies, no seats, no luggage,
Not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, were recovered from the building. Here are four of the five frames, which are the only film footage that the Pentagon has ever released. Four of them entail this growing fireball, but the very first, which is conveniently labeled plane, shows what looks as though it may be a small aircraft just above the gate mechanism there, where I invited Jack White, a legendary photo and film analyst with whom I'd collaborated on JFK research, to scale the image of a Boeing 757 to the size of the tail, which he did, and observe the 757 is more than twice as large as the plane captured in the image, indicating that whatever that may have been, it was clearly not a Boeing 757, which, of course, Flight 77 was alleged to have been. The official trajectory, which was the plane approaching at over 500 miles an hour, barely skimming the ground and encountering a series of lampposts en route to its impact with the building, turns out to be aerodynamically impossible. An aeronautical engineer authored an article at my request explaining that because of the phenomenon known as downdraft, that aircraft at that speed could not have got closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground, where 80 feet is higher than the Pentagon is tall. And had an aircraft moving 500 miles an hour encountered stationary lampposts, it would have had the same effect had the aircraft been stationary and encountered lampposts traveling 500 miles an hour, which would have ripped open the wings. The fuel there would have mixed with oxygen, burst into flame. It would have cartwheeled across the lawn and created a tremendous mess. But as you notice, the lawn was perfectly clear, green, unblemished. Some debris did begin to show up later, and I am convinced it was dropped from a C-140 that was circling the Pentagon at the time. It would have been too awkward to have officers and enlisted men carry this debris out onto the lawn. The most interesting piece of which is shown here, it is a piece from the fuselage of a Boeing 757, but notice, it doesn't show any damage from intense fire or a violent collision, which would crumple it up. And indeed, snared in the fuselage is a piece of vine that is not indigenous to the Arlington, Virginia area. An attorney from Columbus, Ohio, by the name of James Hansen, traced this piece of fuselage back to a crash in Cali, Columbia in 1995. Where a Boeing 757 got off course and crashed through jungle where these vines are indigenous before impacting with a mountain. So the Pentagon very cleverly kept this piece of debris on hand until it could be deployed on an appropriate occasion, which came on 9/11. In addition, when later rumors circulated that the Capitol would be next, congressmen and senators rushed out to the steps. And looking across the Potomac, they saw billowing black smoke, which led me to inquire, where could that have come from, since the civilian lime green fire trucks had extinguished the very modest fires that had remained from the fire. And I discovered they were coming from a series of enormous dumpsters. This was a classic Hollywood special effect. While I was still at Duluth, before I retired in 2006, another student of 9/11 came by and showed me 44 more frames from a National Geographic study, a special that were taken from a different angle where you could see light between the dumpsters and the building. All the smoke was coming from the dumpsters, none from the building. If we turn our attention to Shanksville, where Flight 93 allegedly crashed, we have the unusual phenomenon of a large hole with no debris whatsoever present, where Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force, retired, an expert on air crash investigations, observed to me that it appeared to him someone had gone out with a bulldozer, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up. According to the government, this is what is supposed to have happened when the passengers overcame the Islamic terrorists, the suicide hijackers, who decided to crash the plane. rather than allow it to be re-commandeered by the passengers. During the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, they played what was supposed to be a tape of the passengers talking about using a drink cart to smash down the door, and of the pilot saying, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, which of course is Arabic for God is great, God is great, as they crashed the plane. But as one member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth observed, an organization which I had founded in December of 2005, the cockpit voice recorder does not record voices in the passenger compartment. And in Islam, there is a prayer for every occasion. And if you're facing imminent death, the prayer is not Allah Akbar, but rather in Arabic, there is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So those who were working on the script didn't know enough to get it right. Both of the initial reporters on the scene, Chris Kanicki being interviewed here, reported that the eerie aspect of the crash site was that there was no indication that any plane had crashed there. Here are indications of crashes that actually took place in Missouri, Amsterdam, Russia, and Shanksville. Notice the stunning difference. We don't have any debris of the character and kind for the apparent reason that no plane crashed there. When we turn to New York, we have a rather fascinating situation because we have a host of videos, as many as 52, purporting to show, in this instance, Flight 175 as it approaches the South Tower. As many students have observed, there's the anomalous situation that we have the plane half into the building, half out of the building, with no apparent damage to the building or to the plane, which certainly seems to be very odd indeed. If you have studied the design of the building, you would discover that this plane was intersecting with eight different floors of the South Tower, each floor of which consisted of a steel truss connected at one end to the core columns, at the other to the external steel support columns, which were quite massive and imposing in and of themselves, filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, the variance being because the floors had grooves that were 4 inches deep, so that at some points the cement was 4 inches, at other 8. But because these buildings are 208 feet on a side, that means each floor represented an acre of concrete. So this plane was intersecting with 8 acres of concrete on steel trusses. We know what happens to a commercial carrier in flight if it encounters a small bird weighing a few ounces. Imagine if it were to encounter a single steel truss with an acre of concrete. The windows, by the way, it was often claimed, were wide so the plane effortlessly entered the building, but the opposite is the case. They were specifically designed to be narrow so that the building wouldn't heat up and overwhelm the air conditioning unit. Here is what we are supposed to believe actually took place. This is the Evan Fairbanks video. The plane, it turns out, when we do a frame-by-frame advance, passes its whole length into this massive 500,000-ton building. In the same number of frames, it passes through its whole length in air, so that unless a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building provides no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft than air, what we are observing is a physical impossibility. And indeed, as Ace Baker has observed, what we should have encountered was the plane crunching against the side of the building, wings, tail, body, seats, luggage falling to the ground. The engines might very well have entered the building, but most of the plane would have not. What we actually had was, after the plane disappeared into the building, a very brief delay, and we had a massive explosion, which you observe here. Now, had those planes crumpled, we would have had all that debris on the deck, on the floors and sidewalks beneath, but the fact of the matter is we have photographs for both the North Tower and the South, where the North Tower plane, by contrast, was encountering 7 of those floors equal to an acre of concrete apiece, while the South 8, you could have here been reclining in a lounge chair sipping Mai Tais and been perfectly safe. Jack White also observed that an engine which was found at Church and Murray had been, it appears, delivered by agents wearing FBI vests in a white van. The oddities of the engine include that it was underneath a steel scaffolding. It was sitting on a sidewalk, which ought to have been massively damaged, had an object that weighty hit at high speed. And it's of the wrong type. This is an antiquated engine from an earlier type of 767 that was not in use at the time. So I think in their haste to provide a few props that they didn't bother, they may not have known the difference between this version of the engine and what was currently in use. Notice in the foreground, they even seem to have left behind a dolly that they used in placing it in position. More recently, we had a report of a landing gear that was discovered wedged between two buildings in New York, which upon inspection, the chief of police reported was still attached to a piece of rope that had evidently been used to help to lower it into position. Pilots for 9/11 Truth has done some brilliant work on the aircraft on 9/11. It turns out that two of those planes, Flight 11, North Tower 77, Pentagon, were not even in the air that day, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics records, where we have copies of the original, but were subsequently modified in an attempt to obfuscate that fact, and where they determined, based upon air-ground communication studies, that Flight 93 was over Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, after it had purportedly crashed in Shanksville, and that Flight 175, a report of which is shown here, was determined to be over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had purportedly hit the South Tower. It turns out I obtained Federal Aviation Administration registration records, and the planes that were used for those two flights, 93 and 175, were not formally deregistered or taken out of service until 28 September 2005, raising the question, how can planes that were not even in the air have crashed on 9/11, and how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? I would observe that since none of these planes crashed on 9/11, none of the passengers purported to have been aboard them died in plane crashes that did not occur, nor is it the case that the purported suicide hijackers, 19 in number, 15 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, none of whom were from Iraq, caused those planes to crash. Indeed, as David Ray Griffin observes as the very first point in his magisterial study, the 9/11 Commission report, omissions and distortions, a half a dozen of these guys showed up alive and well the following day, many of whom did interviews with members of the British media. Sandy Hook has been emotionally traumatic for Americans because the very idea that 20 children should have been slaughtered, first graders, in an elementary school in Connecticut, along with six members of the staff, instilled fear across the nation. A key to understanding was what happened here was an interview given by Governor Malloy of Connecticut the day of the event, where Governor Malloy explained that he and the lieutenant governor had been spoken to that something like this might happen, leading me to ponder, something like this, what could he mean? And by whom? There are only really two possibilities, namely that he'd been warned that someone might go berserk and come into a Connecticut school and shoot up a bunch of kids and staff, in which case he had the obligation to notify the school districts to have an elevated level of security, which he did not do. Or alternatively, that he'd been informed they were going to take an abandoned school, conduct a drill, presented as a real event to promote gun control, which is precisely what happened. And when I looked into by whom, I discovered that none other than then Attorney General Eric Holder, well known as an anti-gun zealot, where we have footage of Eric Holder addressing a Democratic Women's National Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1995, was explaining to them, and this was his word, the necessity to brainwash the American people to change their attitude towards guns. Eric Holder was in Connecticut and met with the governor on the 27th of November, just a couple of days and 2 weeks before the event on the 14th. There have been so many anomalies here. On the back cover of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, I put a list of proof that it was a drill. It was right before our eyes. The sign, Everyone Must Check In, which you can actually see in the upper right-hand corner circled. Boxes of bottled water and pizza cartons at the firehouse. Porta-potties present from scratch. Many wearing name tags on lanyards. Parents bringing children to the scene. Can you imagine a parent bringing a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre? It's macabre. But the fact of the matter is, we have now found the FEMA drill for a two-day exercise where the rehearsal was on the 13th, going live on the 14th. They were treating the exercise as a festive occasion. Name tags on lanyard are standard for FEMA drills. They're color-coded to identify the different roles of the different participants. Wolfgang Halbig, who's a former Florida State Trooper and U.S. Customs agent, who had served even as a principal and as a nationally recognized school safety expert, sought to inquire what had happened at Sandy Hook so they could advise other school districts how to avoid it. He found his FOIA inquiries were going unreplied, his phone calls not returned. Shortly thereafter, he found two homicide detectives from a local precinct on his front door in a gated community in Florida on behalf of the Connecticut State Police advising him that if he continued to raise questions about Sandy Hook, that they would have him prosecuted. That was not the right thing to do with Wolfgang, who became a bulldog. And one of his inquiries, which was so mystifying at the time, was who delivered the porta-potties. They wouldn't even give him information about such a seemingly trivial matter for the reason that they were delivered on the 13th, which therefore would have blown open the entire case. On the day of the event, the 14th, we had no surge of EMTs into the building. No medevac helicopter was called. No string of ambulance to the school to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they could be declared to be dead or alive. No evacuation of what should have been 469 other students. No bodies placed on the triage tarps. Now, the confusion between the dates was so great that many of the participants didn't realize the difference and put up donation sites for the families of the victims already on the 13th. And even Adam Lanza had his date of death recorded as having occurred on the 13th in the Social Security Death Index, making his feat in shooting 20 children and 6 adults the following day all the more remarkable. Here are pages from the FEMA manual, which I published in the book as Appendix A, and it says right in the manual, everyone must check in. And, of course, providing restrooms and refreshments is a standard part of a FEMA drill. Here's a photograph from that day, which is interesting in multiple respects. In order to park in the lot, you'd come in Dickinson Drive, only one access route, turn right, curl around, and if you went all the way to the front, you'd turn and park facing away from the building. But they found it so convenient to just bring the cars in a single line that they loaded them two by two by two by two, all facing the building, a telling sign that this was not authentic, but rather, again, setting up props for the drill. If you look carefully, you'll see this school was not Americans with Disability Act compliant with either federal or state law. It had been closed by 2008. We have a mass of evidence about this. Notice it wasn't even a functioning school on this day. Having been closed so long, the boilers were decrepit. They couldn't even heat the school. The ground temperature this day was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. You should have seen steam, heat rising from the building, but there is none, because it was closed. And in fact, not even the parents were allowed to see their children, another striking abnormality, but were shown photographs instead. They claimed to ease the pain and suffering as a parent myself. I find the very idea absurd. If one of my children were reported dead, there'd be no force on earth that could stop me from viewing the body. But these parents were all very compliant. Here's a classic photograph that was sent around the world that was widely construed as being a policewoman leading a string of children from Sandy Hook away from the emergency. The photograph is typically cropped, so you don't see this figure to the left in the foreground. But it turns out there is a second photograph, and that there were many parents there on this occasion, leading to the following question. What, during a shooting massacre, did someone think, gee, I better get on the phone and get some parents down here right away? The very idea is absurd. I initially believed the woman in the blue jacket in the middle was Shannon Hicks, the Newtown Bee photographer who had taken the photograph that we previously saw. But no, Shannon said I was wrong. She claimed about this and almost everything else I had concluded, that she had taken both photographs. But what's fascinating about her having taken both photographs is that the children were rearranged to get a better shot. Look at the photograph at the bottom, which appears to have been the one taken first. You have a little girl in a pink sweater and a short skirt. Look at the above, the photograph taken second that was sent around the world. It's a little boy in a dark sweater and blue jeans. And you can see where else they are located here. Look almost in the middle, between the intersection of the arrow for boy number two and boy number one to the left. There are a couple of parents there in the background who are so relaxed, I refer to them as lounging at the massacre. Now, this is what evacuation ought to have looked like. Stephen Sadensky, who conducted the final report on this event, reported that there were 489 students present that day. If you subtract 20, that meant there should have been 469 for evacuation. You should have strings of these children with someone leading them to safety all over the place. But the fact of the matter is, when we look at dash cam footage for the locations and the times that the police claim the evacuation was taking place, there is nothing there. Sometimes you hear that you can't prove a negative, but that's obviously false. You can prove there's no elephant in your living room, for example, by going to your living room and looking for signs of the presence of elephant. If you find none, you're entitled to conclude there's no elephant there. Here, if you go to the locations and times where the evacuation was supposed to be taking place and find no signs of an evacuation, you're entitled to infer that's because no evacuation was taking place. We have two chapters that are especially fascinating in the book. One is 50 photographs of them furnishing the Lanza home to serve as a prop. This was a very expensive real estate area. The home appears to have been empty. They filled it up with cheap furniture. You can find Adam Lanza's room messy, Adam Lanza's room neat. You can find his bed made. You can find his bed unmade. I think the best of all of those is this, of the Nancy Lanza bedroom. Adam is alleged to have shot his mother in the head four times with a .22 caliber rifle. There's some red stuff on the bed, but it's not blood, and it's not in copious quantity. I believe it may have been raspberry jam. Notice the form on the wooden chest. We find that in many of the other photographs because they were keeping records of how they were arranging the rooms. And Kelly Watt, who has her own commercial and home cleaning service, astutely observed that beneath the leg of the bed, there's a yellow moving pad that in their haste they forgot to remove. Chapter 8 is even more fascinating. 50 photographs of them refurbishing the school to serve as the stage. We have the moving vans present. We have the nameplate for the classroom with a moving sticker still on it. We have this. Exhibit 26. The SWAT team is already there. Just above the roof of the SWAT vehicle, there's a string of four windows in classroom 10 that are undamaged. This is significant because they would claim that the second from the left in particular had been shot out, as I shall show you momentarily, but here it's undamaged. The flag's at full staff. They have crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. And in the middle is none other than Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, reclining against a wall with his arms folded, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. Here's a photograph on the left of the windows in classroom 10 before, the same as in the photograph I just showed, which we now believe was taken on the evening before, the evening of 13 December, before the shooting on the 14th. And on the right, after, notice the damage to that second window. The bottom left, we actually have a photograph of the perps drilling holes in the window frame, the aluminum window frame, to simulate the trajectories of gunshots. And in the lower right, pink rods that illustrate the trajectories that were supposed to have been fired. They're at exactly 90-degree angle with the window, and they're all perfectly parallel, and at exactly 55 degrees from the alleged location within the room from which they were allegedly fired. As a former Marine Corps officer who served as a series commander with 15 drill instructors and 300 recruits under my command, including marksmanship training at Edson Range Camp Pendleton, I can assure you this is a manifest absurdity. No real shooting would have resulted in these perfectly parallel rounds at exactly identical angles. It's a part of a fabrication, and there are multiple other marksmanship experts who have addressed this very same point, making the very same conclusion. So here's a slightly closer view of Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, in the middle waiting for the arrival of the tent. The woman beside him, by the way, appears to be the one who planned the entire Sandy Hook event. Interestingly, InfoWars published an even more clear copy of this photograph, which was up on the website for 38 minutes, during which it had 178 comments, but then it was promptly taken down, and I believe the reason is because of the photograph credit there at the lower right, which states, "Image credits Connecticut State Police," which means that the police, of course, knew they were involved in this hoax. They staged the hoax. And we have a whole lot of photographs that were taken from cameras that were mounted all around the parking area. In any case, this is fantastic evidence that this was a complete scam. Nevertheless, the president on the 16th of January, 2013, this is 1 month and 2 days later, signed no less than 23 executive orders to limit the gun ownership of Americans, and introduced discussion preliminary proposals about a new mental health agenda for elementary school children, the thought of which had never crossed the mind of any adult in the United States before, but which presages the introduction of a new billion-dollar industry for a totally unnecessary program that's going to immensely benefit private interests. Because so much of this revolves around gun control, I included an appendix demonstrating that when guns are banned, crime goes up. And let me just mention another illustration of the mountain of proof we have. A Los Angeles area superintendent of schools by the name of Paul Preston was so disturbed by what he saw being reported from Sandy Hook that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, each of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no children had died, and that it was done to promote gun control. You can find his interview with Sophia Smallstorm in Chapter 5. The Boston bombing is fascinating because it was so amateurish that almost anyone can appreciate what happened here without having the kinds of emotional resistance that were generated by the very idea of 20 children having died there. Interestingly, by the way, they seem to have faked the images of the children by using photographs of children that were about 10 years old. Many students observed that they weren't wearing clothing that would be worn by then contemporaneous children, even in the first grade. And there are also many other indications that it was contrived this way to create a whole photographic sequence of the alleged victims by using photographs that were from their life 10 years earlier. Indeed, we even have one video YouTube where one of these young men, Tommy Mattioli, is attending his own funeral. Now, in Boston, the evidence is overwhelming. We have a video where in the background you can hear the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill! This is a drill!" Believe it or not, over and beyond that, we have the Boston Globe tweeting, "Breaking news, police will have controlled explosion on 600 block on Boylston Street." Officials, the second tweet, "There will be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute as part of bomb squad activities." And lo and behold, 1 minute later, opposite the Boston Public Library, there is an explosion. Now, I can assure you that as a former artillery officer, that this was a puff piece. This was not a serious explosive. It couldn't have killed anyone. We had smoke. We had noise. We had purported victims. But as you will see, there are so many anomalies. It appears that no one actually died at the Boston Marathon, nor was anyone even injured. Take a look here. You have smoke. You have various bodies. You have people who are missing body parts, but you have no blood. You have no blood. Now, as Lorraine Day, who is the chief of trauma surgery at San Francisco General Hospital, observed for 25 years, she took care of massive injuries from gang wars, explosions, severe motor vehicle crashes, survivors of attempted suicide by jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge. One. In the pictures taken immediately after the blast, there is no blood on the ground. That could never be. The bomb blast instantaneously would have spread blood from the injured victims everywhere. Two, there were only about 10 victims at ground zero of the blast, and all of them are alive and do not appear to be even close to death. Where are these other 200 people who are supposedly injured? Were the reports of the number of injured run as high as 260? But you can search in vain if you are going to identify any of them. Three, when blood does eventually appear on the sidewalk at ground zero, it clearly is some kind of paint, not blood. The paint is bright orangish red, obviously for maximum frightening effect. Real blood is dark maroon. Here's an example of what she means. Look at the brightness of the blood compared with real blood. There was a lot of it. And it came out of tubes. This is Hollywood blood. This is a Hollywood-style special effect. And notice in the middle, the blood, the bone extension on the leg of a man who is identified as Jeff Bauman. If we go back to the earlier version, if you look carefully on the left side of each photograph, there's a man in a hoodie who is assisting in attaching a false prosthesis with a bone extension in an evident effort to make the event seem even more horrific. Now, what you would do with a victim like that is leave him horizontal. You'd have to tie up the, put tourniquets on his legs to make sure no loss of blood, because with injuries like these, you'd be unconscious in 1 minute, dead in two. The last thing you would do would be to put him in a wheelchair and rush him away where gravity could help to draw the blood down. The individual in the middle in the cowboy hat, his name is Carlos Arredondo. He has been identified as an actor whom Nathan Foulkes, who identified him, had cast in one of his own films. We find him in various footage standing in the background until his time comes to enter into the script. Here he rushes alongside of Jeff Bauman holding a piece of rag that is too loose to serve as a tourniquet. This police officer is one of those involved here in these lime-colored vests. They appear to have been off-duty. Again, there was no surge of EMTs to the scene, no string of ambulance, even priests. Two priests who sought to reach those who they were in the belief were about to die were refused access to them. And notice this, quite fascinating. This is 19 days later. Jeff Bauman, you may have noted, had his legs blown off beneath the knees. Now, 2 days later, this is supposed to be Jeff Bauman receiving accolades from the crowd at a Boston Bruins hockey game. He has his legs cut off above the knee. I had an interesting conversation with Dr. Stan Monteith on his radio show before his demise, where Dr. Stan, who himself is an orthopedic surgeon, was explaining to me that he has performed these surgeries, and it takes 3 months just to recover from the surgery, and then another 3 to learn to get around without your legs. Yet here you have a man who purports to be Jeff Bauman, and I would suggest a close inspection shows this is another party altogether, but that's who he was presented as having been 19 days later, which appears to be medically impossible if the injuries had been real. Now, Nathan Folk, shown here, had identified Carlos as an actor he had cast in his film on the prosecution of a president of George W. Bush for war crimes involved in 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. When I went to the website, which would normally give the complete cast and crew of the film, it was cut off after the four or five principal actors, so you couldn't read the name of Carlos Arredondo. I've interviewed Nathan before. I know Nathan, so I wrote to him and said, Nathan, who was it, just to verify, in which film? And he wrote back, of course, that it was Carlos Arredondo and the prosecution of a president. And I pointed out to him that they'd edited. I mean, this is the kind of thing your government is doing to try to prevent you from gaining access to evidence. Now, Nathan, here's an actor waiver form of the kind they use, and they recruit amputee actors, just as they do other actors, and we'll find in other events they did this. The reason, by the way, appears to be that in the wake of 9/11, they found that if you really kill people, they can have friends and relatives who aren't happy about it. In the case of 9/11, four women who were survivors of men who died in the Twin Towers formed a political effort. They were known as the Jersey Girls, to force Bush and Cheney to conduct a 9/11 investigation. They put it off for 441 days. But finally, under pressure from the Jersey Girls, they were forced to introduce a 9/11 commission. They handled it quite deftly by appointing as the executive director Philip Zelikow, who'd come from the inner sanctum of the Bush-Cheney administration, and who had as his area of specialization in academia before he left higher education for the government, the creation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S, which is exactly what they gave us with the 9/11 Commission report. Interestingly, when Bush and Cheney finally testified, they did so only under the condition that it would not be under oath, that they could testify together, and that no notes would be taken. You would have supposed this was the interrogation of two mafia dons, not the president and vice president of the United States. Nathan was the first to mention to me the possibility the smoke hadn't even come from a bomb, but had come from a smoke machine. And believe it or not, Alan William Powell, who produced the chapter of photographs about the participants in the bombs for the Boston bombing, discovered the smoke machine itself is present. Just so we have both photographs of the smoke machine and also of the tubes from which the blood came, because of which I subtitled this book, State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects. Now, we know, actually, the alternative media cracked the case already the evening of the Marathon bombing. It was done by Kraft International personnel. This was a company founded by Chris Kyle, also known as the American Sniper, about whom a movie was made for him shooting some 150 Iraqis, where we had no business having invaded Iraq in the first place, and who recently obtained a degree of celebrity for claiming to have punched out Jesse Ventura in a bar, where Jesse launched a lawsuit, which he won. But in the meanwhile, Kyle had died, so, you know, it was spun politically as though Jesse was going after the widow of this American hero. But the fact is that this company, run by Chris Kyle, they wear khaki trousers, dark jackets, baseball caps with a skull insignia, where the motto of Kraft is, violence does solve problems. Notice the Kraft International employees on the left, in particular the black backpack with a white square. It would turn out the black backpack with a white square was one of two that exploded. These were the backpacks that contained the bombs. So we have photos of them in the vicinity of those backpacks that exploded, then rushing away, no longer wearing the backpack. Doesn't leave a lot of doubt about it, but consider this. This is marathon footage of the two brothers who were accused of the crime. Neither of them is wearing a black nylon backpack. I consulted John Remington Graham, who is a retired professor of law. He's been both a prosecutor and a defense attorney. And he pointed out to me that the fact that the backpacks don't match meant that there was not even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment and a conviction at trial. And indeed, not only does the FBI report state they were black nylon backpacks, but the indictment of Zocher, the younger of the brothers, for trial states the same thing. The alternative media had been so successful in cracking the crime that they sent out an FBI stooge 4 days later to say, don't look at any of those other photographs, only look at these we are providing you now, and requested the public's assistance in identifying the perps, Joker and Tamerlan Saraneva. Where, notice here that Tamerlan, the older and taller, is clean-shaven in this image. They were basically saying, don't look at the man behind the curtain. They appealed for the public's help in their identification, but it would turn out that the FBI had had the brothers under surveillance for at least 5 years and knew perfectly well who they were. So we have this anomalous situation at the time. Suspect number one would die in police custody. This is the older brother, as I'm now about to explain. Suspect number two was at the time on the loose, but they are supposed to be the ones responsible, not these men wearing the black nylon backpack seen before and after at the location where the bombs went off. As this observes, you can't make this stuff up. Here's Tamerlan, the older brother, who was stripped naked and put into a police car. Much fanfare at the time. It was on all the media. I could identify them, but how much better that he was identified by his mother and his aunt. Stripped naked, put into the police car. If you had an image that's not, doesn't have his face quite so obliterated, you could see that he, at the time, had a beard. In fact, I was astonished when Murat Saranova, their aunt, explained to me this footage of them at the marathon had been photoshopped. And I said, how do you know? How can you prove it? And she began sending me a photograph of Tamerlan lying in bed with his cat. He has a beard. A link to a video from a gymnasium where Tamerlan and Zocher were working out. He has a beard. He had a dinner in the evening after a friend called, relieved to find he'd been nowhere near the Boston bombing. And that dinner that night, he had a beard. They were photographed at a convenience store, Zocher inside, Tamerlan outside. He had a beard. When he was arrested, if you saw a better version, he has a beard. And when his body is presented to the public, he has a beard. Now, think about this. Zocher, the younger brother, was accused of having murdered his older brother, Tamerlan. But how could Zocher have murdered Tamerlan after Tamerlan had been taken into police custody, which was done with great fanfare? The American people are so oblivious to what's going on before their very eyes, they cannot put two and two together. Zocher's arrested by police. Tamerlan arrested by police. Tamerlan shows up dead. Zocher? How can he have done it? Answer, he cannot. We even have a witness who reported seeing the police driving over Tamerlan three times in an SUV, which appears to have been his own vehicle. And that's not the worst of it. They had a friend who lived in South Florida, Ibrahim Todashev, who was worried that they were coming to kill him. Five FBI agents came to his home. Normal practice would be to come in pairs, one who takes notes while the other interrogates. Four of them left, and the one who remained claimed that Ibrahim attacked him and he had to shoot him five times. So he is very dead. That was your FBI at work, which I can assure you, based upon my experience, spends more time covering up crimes and malfeasance by the government than it does protecting the American people or solving them. What was going on in Boston? Well, there was a huge lockdown of the city with a massive military presence. This was undermining posse comitatus, a statute from 1878 that precludes the use of military forces to perform police functions. They were also subverting the Fourth Amendment, which is protection from unreasonable search and seizure. They were going from home to home throughout Boston and requiring people to vacate their homes and search for a single 19-year-old college student who, in fact, had nothing to do with it. And in the third place, they were demonizing Muslims. The young men, I believe, were selected, at least in part because they were from the Chechnya region. They were Muslim. And the New York Times, believe it or not, would publish page after page of very fine details about their alleged life and training as terrorists in Chechnya. So this whole thing was another elaborate fraud, in my opinion, much simpler and easier to see through than Sandy Hook, which does not carry the same amount of emotional baggage because we're not dealing with the death of 20 children. More recently, of course, we have the event in California, San Bernardino. I was born in Pasadena, grew up in Southern California. My mother was born in Pomona, so this was hardly unfamiliar territory for me. We had many reports that were very odd, including that the suspects, again a Muslim husband and wife in this instance, had been engaged in a shootout with the police, and yet look at the driver's side window. It shot out. How could you have a shootout with police if your window was rolled up? There are lots of bullet holes in the car, but they're restricted to the windows. In fact, this appears to have been a police vehicle. They didn't want to shoot it up. They didn't even shoot out the wheels. It was one that was under remote control, so the police could create the impression that they were trying to make an escape. There were lots of people present who seemed to be milling around. They didn't have any obvious function. Their presence there was anomalous. I went through both the Sandy Hook and San Bernardino events with a paramedic of a very high level of training, and he pointed out example after example of violation of standard operating procedure in a crisis situation of the kinds represented here, which any of you can find online if you go to The Real Deal, episode number 137, staging attacks from Sandy Hook to San Bernardino. The reason why they were milling around appears to be this. We discovered the Craigslist ad for extras in San Bernardino with a call day of December 1st, reporting December 2nd, good pay, refreshments, transportation, some speaking roles. They have become so blatant about faking these events that they will even go to a public advertising site like Craigslist to recruit their participants. The attorney hired by the family was not so easily taken in. He observed that there are lots of questions here and even made comparisons with Sandy Hook, whether that was a real incident or not. Of course, he was pilloried for suggesting that Sandy Hook might have been a contrived event. But as you already can tell from the evidence I presented here, of which there's a mountain more available, including in the book, a 425-page book, which I released as a PDF when they banned it by Amazon.com, it doesn't seem plausible to him, and this is a very good attorney, by the way, that this petite woman would be involved in this sort of hyper-caricatured Bonnie and Clyde crazy scenario. She was indeed petite. She weighed about 90 pounds, and she had a newly born infant. And I dare say that it's highly contrary to believe that a woman with a new infant is going to go on some kind of terrorist rampage that's bound to leave her dead and her infant defenseless. Indeed, when they pulled the bodies out of the vehicle, they were already handcuffed. And if you take a close look at the face, there was a pixelization, there was alteration to the face, suggesting that it had been photoshopped. And when we look further, it appears they used a dummy here. There's one on the right. It's a new type of dummy. It's flesh-like. It'll bleed. You can cut it up, and it looks like a real person. I published one of many articles about these events, in which I included a report about this new type of dummy, which appears to have been used in there in San Bernardino. Here's a photograph of the two culprits, presumably, which a photographic expert has observed was photoshopped, that this is a composite photograph. It's not legitimate or bona fide. Among the other extraordinary indications that this was some kind of contrived event is that the media were allowed to virtually ransack the apartment where they had been living. Had this been a legitimate event, it would have been screened off with crime scene tape and it would have been the subject of meticulous forensic study. Instead, journalists were allowed through the house and they made quite a mess of it. In addition, there's a report of three men, military types, of having opened fire on the crowd of some 14 who are alleged to have died. And from the characteristics and description of this CIA contractor, Stephen D. Kelly, he believes they may have been Kraft International, but notice with different trousers. They were wearing khaki trousers in Boston. Here they would appear to have been wearing black trousers. Those photographs, I believe, are actually from Boston rather than at San Bernardino, but they certainly seem to have similar characteristics, even if they're in a variation of the garb. What's most interesting about this report is not every aspect to it, but the second of the three bulleted points. But let me go through all three. The two attackers who were killed by police, husband and wife Saeed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, were both devout Muslims. So again, we're demonizing Muslims. I mean, that's a regular theme. 19 Islamic fundamentalist Muslims, 9/11, two Muslim brothers, Boston bombing, a Muslim couple, San Bernardino. They left a remote control bomb behind after the attack, which fortunately did not detonate. The triggering device was identical to the explosives used in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, which was carried out by Muslim refugees. Except that Tamerlan and Zucker had nothing to do with it. They were framed. They were set up. The FBI had them under observance for 5 years. They weren't even there. Their images were photoshopped in, and when they did, they were so sloppy they didn't get the backpacks right. You would have thought if they're going to frame them, they would have at least given them black nylon backpacks so they could claim to be comparable to those that exploded. But in fact, they blundered, and that's true of these events, that those who are carrying them out are not rocket scientists, and they make mistakes. Third, it was reported that both the shooters wore digital GoPro cameras to record the massacre, just as ISIS members in Paris and other locations have done. Well, that's really something, isn't it, claiming that they had very sophisticated pieces of camera on them. We're going to look at Paris, too, and you'll discover Paris was yet one more of these fake events. The reaction of the White House to San Bernardino was simply stunning, because the White House said that when gun laws are passed, these terrorist attacks will cease, leading the actor Kurt Russell to go ballistic and saying, "This is idiotic. Why would anyone think terrorists are going to seek to attack if we pass gun laws?" Leading me to observe, gee, I've never heard of the organization Terrorists for Gun Control. What I think that the White House was telling us, if you read between the lines, is that they're staging these terrorist attacks, and once they've succeeded in motivating the passage of gun control laws, there will be no necessity to pass any more, to stage any more of these attacks. So it turns out to be true, if you understand what you're being told by the White House, that when these terrorist attacks will cease, when gun control laws are passed. Here we had Obama talking about San Bernardino, and of course he managed to work in Sandy Hook. He had been very consistent about talking about Sandy Hook until the book Nobody Died was released and banned. And then he took a hiatus and did not mention Sandy Hook. But now he's bringing it back, And he seems to have had something on his finger that induces a tear to run from your eyes. He's not crying now, and indeed we could ask, why would the president be crying about an event 3 years old when at the time the parents of the alleged deceased weren't crying? Here you have on the top left Robbie Parker, who is coming out to meet the press the day after the shooting to talk about the death of his daughter Emily, and he is in a jovial mood, jocular mood, laughing, smiling. Then he notices the assembled press. He stops, he hyperventilates to get into character, proceeds to talk in a solemn voice about the loss of his daughter Emily, but has a presence of mind to mention her donation website. And indeed, the fact is that those donation websites have been so successful that the families of the alleged victims have received in excess of 27, perhaps as much as $130 million, over $1 million apiece. Even the police, who played bit roles here on the scene as first responders, have divvied up $2.3 million. The Newtown School District, which had a white elephant on its hands in this school that was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, have been severely ravaged by hurricanes in the past, was gifted $50 million for a new kindergarten through fourth grade school, where when I looked into the matter, elementary schools, kindergarten through fourth grade, averaged only $7 million across the country. One of the parents, by the name of Lenny Posner, has made it his mission in life to attack the websites of those of us who have been pursuing the truth about Sandy Hook. He has claimed copyright infringement from images of his purported son, Noah, who is a highly unusual little boy, because not only is Noah reported to have died in Newtown on 14 December 2012, but again in Pakistan on 16 December 2014. And when Kelly Watt, who had over 100 hours of conversation with Lenny Posner, explained to him she didn't believe a word he said, she didn't believe he had a son, she didn't believe he could prove any of it, he sent her a copy of a death certificate that turned out to be a total fabrication. I put it in the book. It's a legitimate bottom of a real death certificate with a fake top that doesn't even have a file number. It has the wrong estimated time of death as 11 a.m. When the shooting all took place between 9:30 and 9:35. I can assure you if Lenny Posner had actually lost a son, Noah, at Sandy Hook, he could have presented a bona fide death certificate, not an obvious fake. The figure on the lower right is a woman named Lynn McDowell, whose daughter Grace was alleged to have died at Sandy Hook. This is Lynn during an interview with Sanders Anderson Cooper, where she's all dolled up and flirting with Anderson, evidently unaware of his preferences. But there is no inkling of anxiety, of trauma, of grief present whatsoever. And we find this true again, again, and again. There are two recent developments that are interesting. There's a new YouTube talking about the author of one of the previously 20 books about Sandy Hook that you can buy on YouTube, where there was only one of the 20 that offered views at variance with the government. My book, which, of course, was the one that was banned. One of these books is by a woman named Caitlin Roig, who claimed to be a first-grade teacher, who packed 15 of her students into a bathroom 3x4. And if you assume that the students weigh an average of 50 pounds, that's 750 pounds of squirming first graders, plus Caitlin, who must weigh another 100 pounds. 850 pounds in a 3x4 bathroom where the door swung in. I observe, just compare, say, a guard or tackle for the NFL who weighs 350 pounds. That guy takes up that whole facility. I mean, this is simply absurd. Here's another absurdity. One of the fathers is named David Wheeler. He not only played the role of a grieving father on at Sandy Hook, but also a law enforcement official in camouflage. He walked up and down Dickinson Drive carrying an AR-15, believe it or not, upside down and by the magazine. I'm telling you, this is one somebody who has no familiarity with weapons, but Barack Obama flew them and others to Washington, D.C., and put him and his wife, Francine, who, like himself, is a B-grade actor, on television, where she gave an impassioned appeal for gun control from the White House. That's the nature of the beast going on here. Turning to Paris for an international variation, of course, needless to say, we had a lot of weeping and flowers and grief displayed. This is an event where there was supposed to have been a mass slaughter in this club. This photograph is very interesting because it's very clearly photoshopped. There are lots of demonic signs being shown there. It's just a complete fake. And in this photograph, we see the scene afterwards. Those are not real bodies. That blood appears to have been put down using a mop. And if you look up at the stage, the band called, Eagles of Death Metal. I mean, that's an odd name. They're a California band. Eagles of Death Metal. Had the presence of mind to put their set together. They put together the drum set and all that during the shooting. I guess it was just natural instinct. They just respond spontaneously. Here's an alleged victim walking around with blood on his shirt, which, however, is inside out. Nice touch. We have a government operative caught in the act of throwing a firecracker into a cafe during the Paris terrorist attack. We also have a tweet, 120 dead tweeted during the attack 2 days before the event. Shades of the Boston Globe tweets about the bomb that would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library. We have a French media grilling an official over the exact scenario of the November 13th attacks because we had the same scenario as one that happened that very night in a drill. This is what happened in London during the 7/7 London bombing attacks. There was a private company coordinated by a fellow named Peter Power to have a simulation of attacks on three subway stations and a bus in Tavistock Square. And would you believe that when the attack took place, it was on the same tube stops at the same time as the drill, and a bus in Tavistock Square was also exploded. Nicholas Kullerstrom, PhD, who has contributed to all three of the Moonrock books, blew the case apart when he discovered that the train from Luton, that the four young men, Muslim again, who are going to be blamed for the bombing, would have had to have taken to have been at the tube stops in time, where it appears they were induced to play the role of actors. But the train from Luton was canceled. They couldn't make it on time. Therefore, they couldn't possibly have been responsible. And who has published Terror on the Tube, now in its third edition, where they made their way to Canary Wharf, where the international press are located, trying to reach Reuters to tell what had actually happened. But the bobbies cordoned off the area and shot them dead. I mean, you know, after all, they can no longer talk about what happened to them once they're gone. And believe it or not, just as we had Eric Holder, the attorney general, meeting with the governor of the state of Connecticut in advance, the CIA director met with the French security chief before the Paris attacks. This is getting extraordinarily embarrassing, and something of which most Americans are unaware. On the 3rd of October 2012, a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security released a report based upon its review of 680 fusion center studies. With these fusion centers, merge federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity. In those 680 reports, which were gathered all over the country during 2009 and 2010, they found not a single instance of domestic terrorist activity. None. Zip. Zilch. Zero. Nada. Nor any case in which a fusion center had thwarted a planned terrorist attempt. Because of the size of this sample, 680 from all over the United States, a very reasonable statistical inference to conclude that domestic terrorism is non-existent or virtually non-existent in the United States, which, of course, is the reason why they have had to fabricate these terrorist attacks, where Obama has been telling us again and again how gun violence has been going up, But the facts are precisely the opposite. I looked into the matter and discovered studies that show that gun violence has been steadily declining during the 20 years from 1993 to 2014. For example, as the top graph shows, deaths from gun violence have dropped from 7.0 per 100,000 to 3.4. In other words, it had been more than cut in half in the last 20 years. It has been steadily dropping. The injuries from gun violence have even shown an even more dramatic drop. They, from 725.3 per 100,000 ages 12 and older in 1993 to 174.8 in 2014. The situation is simply absurd. The very idea that we should be surrendering our guns at this point in history is an obscenity. There are neocons in the Obama administration who are desperately seeking to provoke a war with Russia. They include Victoria Nuland in the Department of State, Samantha Power, our ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who's Obama's national security advisor, Ash Carter, who's our Secretary of Defense. They are all eager to provoke a war with Russia. The first effect would be that Washington, D.C. and New York would be taken out. We would be in a post-nuclear Jericho scenario for those familiar with the television series, where communities could only protect themselves from marauding gangs who want to rape and loot and pillage if they are armed. A study was done in two Georgia towns where one was required to give up all of their weapons. The other was required to take weapons training, and every home was required to have a weapon. In the town where every home was required to have a weapon, the crime rate fell to virtually zero. In the town where they had weapons taken away, the crime rate skyrocketed. I thought it was ironic during that press conference that Barack Obama would refer to Chicago in relation to the growing gun violence, because Chicago may be the community in the United States that has the most stringent gun control laws. Many law enforcement officials are in agreement now. The average period of time to respond, by the way, to an emergency call to the police is 20 minutes. But the mayhem takes place typically in the first five. So if you call the police and hope that they will arrive with their guns, you may be waiting in vain, because the mayhem takes place in the first five. So your daughter may have been raped, your wife mugged, you may have been killed while waiting for the police to arrive. So many law enforcement officials, including the Detroit police chief, are suggesting arm the citizens to deter terrorists. A New York sheriff just issued a similar call to arms, encouraging Americans to obtain firearms and learn how to use them to protect themselves. The situation is a complete absurdity. It's one we are in because the administration is somehow, for some reason, desperate to take firearms out of our hands. My most recent surmise has been that it's related to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because if that were to pass, it would create a board of super corporate lawyers who have the right to override any statute or law, including the Constitution of the United States, if it conflicts with their interpretation. And I believe that Obama is concerned that a lot of Americans, discovering that he has promoted the abdication of the sovereignty of the United States of America, may be pissed off about it. You can obtain more about all of these at Moonrock Books. I want to thank you all for being here and answer any questions you have about what I've discussed or other issues. Thank you.